Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and to this edition of Women's Wednesday. Women's Wednesday is the day that we talk to all kinds of women about all kinds of things that impact and have impacted their lives. Today's guest is an author who has written a quite poignant, but I think important story about her life. I am very pleased to introduce to you Maggie Knipe. She is the author of Now Everyone Will Know, The Perfect Husband, His Shattering Secret, My Rediscovered Life. Maggie, welcome to Mind Talk. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Pamela. Good to be here.
Now, Maggie, you know, there are so many stories. There are so many secrets that families have in their lives. You talk about in Now Everyone Will Know about the family secrets, relationship secrets, and how to rebound from such a tragedy. What made you decide to actually write Now Everyone Will Know? You could have gone your lifetime and not done this.
I think, Pamela, there were a couple of starting points for me in writing this book. One of them was primarily that as a woman who was pretty much required to keep silent on the subject that I wrote about because of the stigma involved, decreasingly liked the feeling of being of having to do that. I had a sort of historical perspective that I felt that I always felt that women in literature and history had often been silenced and blamed. And then I had also one quote drove me, and this is there were a couple of quotes. David Geffen once at a Hollywood event said, "You're only as sick as your secrets." That was one quote.
Yeah.
The other quote was a Maya Angelou quote, who once said, "There is no greater agony than bearing an untold story." And the third quote was a Martin Luther King quote, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." I felt that I needed to talk when I could. One more sort of takeoff point was that my children had grown up and I protected them all their lives from the stigma. And we had, to that end, not spoken of their father at all. So when each graduated from their respective colleges, they mentioned him poignantly. And I felt now is the time to revisit what happened and this individual who was my husband and their father.
Okay.
So I started to write. And the book resulted.
Well, it sounds like you gave it a great deal of thought, and I can certainly tell by the quotes that you offer that this is something that clearly was very important to you and very meaningful to you. Let's start with your childhood. You described a childhood and an early adulthood sort of fraught with your wish for your dad's approval that you kind of didn't get. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. I had a wonderful father whom I miss every day. He was conventional in some ways in those days. You know, he wanted a daughter, I think, who was pretty close to perfect.
Yeah.
And yet my mother was, although coming from a very poor background in Brooklyn, a daughter of immigrants, was a very early and ardent feminist. So I had conflicting messages growing up. I was also a little larger as a woman, you know, and today I would be sort of in the sort of the sweet spot, you know.
Yeah.
But back then in the 50s and 60s, I was just what they used to call chunky, and I never felt very graceful. My mother put me in dance, I thought presciently and wisely, and I loved it. But I had issues with food my whole life, you know, nothing. I had to try to stay thin for dance, so I had those pressures. I also had those pressures from my father. So, I mean, and to complicate my childhood further, as I'm sure you read, Pamela, I had an older brother who was, I knew something was amiss with him intellectually, but my parents, as what was typical in those days, did not want to see it or acknowledge it, and there weren't the systems in schools and in society and communities that helped disabled children, intellectually disabled children. So I kind of knew that I had to be what I would call son and daughter, and successful at that growing up.
And also, you speak of your having a disabled brother. As you said, there were none of the systems in place that are available nowadays. And it was another thing to keep a secret about.
That's right. That's right. So that what I would say, I would sort of protect my brother. And then years later, just to jump ahead, I would try to talk to my parents about it. And they would not talk to me about it. And they did not want me to talk about it.
Speaking of getting yourself involved in situations that your family would have preferred not to talk about, at one point you fell in love with a black man, and you are not a black woman. You fell in love with him, and you dated him for 3 years. What was the reaction of family and friends to that?
Well, that's a, you know, that's a, it's a long time ago, and sometimes when you're writing, you know, the details you either tried to forget or forget come up. To that end, an interesting little sidelight, there's a book about organizing out there, and I've been going through letters I hadn't read in a long time, and I realized how deeply in love I was with this young man. I was in my early 20s, very early 20s, and he was too, and my family, I'm Jewish, and my mother worked at a major university in Philadelphia, and she was very involved with some of the students who were young black women getting their Ivy League degrees. And so they were sort of on paper very open to my, on paper one would have thought they were open, and they seemed open to my interracial relationship, but they struggled with it. It was embarrassing to them. On the flip side, my significant other at the time's family did not even meet me. They didn't want to meet me. I think they considered my, at that time, boyfriend superior to me. His mother was a doctor. And they didn't, and I was trying to be a dancer, and they thought, what is he doing with this young woman? He had gone to an Ivy League school. He was a banker. He was going on to another degree at an Ivy League school, and I had not followed his trajectory. So I would say on a micro level, there was disapproval for many reasons, and probably because I wasn't a black woman. His mother, who was a black doctor, you know, did not want, she wanted him to date somebody from their own race, who was also successful. There were many women coming up then. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, both families, both your family and his family, wanted someone who fit within sort of the social structure that they knew and held the standing that they were familiar with.
That's, on the other hand, I will say that he was welcomed in my home, but I don't think I was welcomed in his, which is maybe sounds surprising, but that was a situation. So we were very discordant. It didn't work. We had to end it.
And then came along, you know, the idea that you would not have been welcomed in his family is actually not that much of a surprise, certainly in those days and still to some extent with some families in these days. So clearly, I mean, both of you had a lot of competing energies, if you will, that would have gotten in the way of your relationship. And I know that as in reading your book, that when he went off to college and the two of you were talking about marriage, that sort of blew everybody's mind. So that relationship ended.
Yes.
At some point, you met John, the person who would ultimately become your husband. Tell us about that time when you first met John. What were your first impressions of him?
So I met this blind date arranged by a high school friend who had gone to Brown University and Harvard Business School with my late husband, John. That night that I met him, I describe it, I remember that, and this is writing a memoir, you recall, sometimes things come back and you can't believe that you remember them so crisply, but I met him on a cold April night in the mid-80s, and I remember walking into this Tribeca with Lower Manhattan Bar and seeing a very compelling-looking young man. We were both in approaching 30 at that time, well, we were in our very late 20s, and he was, how he related to me immediately was as an interested person, a listener. And he was billed as a financial journalist, and he was a financial journalist, and I thought he would have a plastic pocket pen holder. I had a very stereotypical image of him, but he had bright red hair and very hip glasses and an orange Swatch watch, which I noticed immediately. Swatch watches were very in back then. For both men and women, and he had a very nice build, and I thought, this is a smart and attractive guy. And we really connected intellectually, physically, emotionally. We had come from dissimilar backgrounds in that he was not Jewish, but he had grown up in Bethesda, actually, and he was had many Jewish friends and had gone to a school with many Jewish friends. And so we connected in a socioeconomic, if you will, semi-cultural way, although there was a real difference as it evolved between our families as well, our own families as well.
Right. So he actually grew up in Bethesda, Maryland.
Yes.
Okay. So here was this guy, I mean, after breaking up with someone who you really cared about, but for all the reasons we discussed, that relationship didn't move forward. And now you meet somebody who, again, not quite the exact person that your parents would have preferred, but still, he sounds like he was almost a dream come true.
Yes. To your point, to your question, I think it's important to say that my parents, it was interesting. My parents never sort of railroaded me, and that's a pejorative judgmental term, but they didn't railroad me into dating or marrying someone Jewish. That was not something it's very typical in culture sometimes, for, as you know, as I think you would know, especially from your line of work, for people to be sort of streamlined or directed into something. My parents didn't say it has to be someone Jewish. What they did, I think, silently indicate was it had to be somebody smart and classy.
Okay.
And that was, and so was my former boyfriend, my African American boyfriend. He was smart and classy, but that went way over the line, if you will. So, but I wasn't pummeled emotionally into going out with one kind of person.
Okay. And quite frankly, the way you describe John, pummeled or not, he was kind of an eye-catching good fit.
He was an eye-catching good fit. He was the right age, Pamela. He was on a great upward path at work at a prestigious newspaper. And he was delightful. He was a wonderful supporter of mine in whatever I did, except that he didn't want me to be an artist. And I was, and this is key, I think. I had a master's in dance. I wanted to continue on that road and keep auditioning or trying. And he made it very clear to me that he needed a partner who made a living. So I shifted gears when I first went out with him and got a job in marketing and publicity.
Did you enjoy that work?
I mean, I think that I enjoyed it because it was interesting and could be creative, and I had a degree in English, and I was I loved to write back then as well, but I missed having the freedom to pursue my interest in the arts. And once, just after we married, I went back into choreographing musicals and teaching dance and what I had wanted to do. But while we were dating, I had to do what he thought was best for our financial situation. He did not want to support. He said he didn't want to support his girlfriend, or didn't want to be in that position.
Interesting. Well, you ultimately did marry, and you describe it as really an idyllic life. You had important friends. You had a sexy, romantic husband. At some point, you had a beautiful new daughter.
Yes.
Life was good.
It was the kind of life. I remember sitting, I think James Taylor had Never Die Young was his CD that came out when I just had my daughter, beautiful songs. I remember sitting and listening to that over and over again in my Hoboken condo and thinking, this is exactly what I wanted in life at that moment.
Right.
Yeah. So that's an episodic answer to your question.
Now, you also, at some point, you had a second pregnancy.
Yes.
And that's when you say that things really kind of began to change in your household.
Yes.
What were some of the perhaps subtle changes that you first noticed with your husband?
Well, I wish I had noticed them more acutely or perceptively at the time, which I didn't. But in recollection, he was not feeling so well. He was tired. Would come home from work very exhausted. I, at the same time, was choreographing a local musical, and I was pregnant with a very big baby, and I was also tired. So like many married couples, with one child and another on the way, that didn't seem unusual. He did come home with some, I don't know, he had a couple months before I was pregnant, he had contracted chickenpox from our baby daughter, and adults get chickenpox pretty severely, so the doctor didn't think anything was strange about that. He had flu. He was just sort of a level of exhaustion, and then and some low level, low hum of depression. He work had gotten very intense for him. He was starting another section of his newspaper. It was a great opportunity for him, but he was stressed about it. He developed some skin conditions. This was going on for about almost during the whole time I was pregnant with our second child, and his enthusiasm lagged. He didn't exhibit the same sort of buoyancy towards the pregnancy. I think I was so busy I didn't register it enough, but this was what was going on.
Well, and then, you know, there's no particular reason why you would have registered it. And certainly we know that hindsight is always completely brilliant. But, from what you describe from the outside looking in, it would be easy to understand somebody saying he's stressed. This is just stress. He's exhausted. You know, he's got a lot on his plate. It's just stress.
Right. And the doctors, by the way, he did go to some physicians, and the doctors said, that's what they said, Pamela. He also was, one night his chest hurt, and I thought, well, you know, just take something. But he said it really, really hurts. I took him to the hospital in the city of St. Vincent's Hospital. He went to the emergency room. I got someone to watch our daughter, and it was something called pleurisy, which was like a lung infection, and they gave him some medication. It cleared it up, and they said he looks exhausted. That's what I got over and over again from medical professionals.
Yeah, and that was St. Vincent's Hospital in New York?
Yes, that was a hospital in New York, yes.
Oh, okay. So, again, you actually, you know, you're saying that you wished you had noticed more earlier, but it sounds like you noticed everything that any reasonable person would have noticed and considered during that time. And if you've got a series of doctors telling you and your husband that it's fatigue and you could identify where the fatigue would come from, no reason for you to think it was anything else other than fatigue.
Right. That's right.
What about your friends and family? Did they notice anything about your husband?
You know, two. I can remember two situations, and only two. One, we went to see. This was really later, though, not during the time, not before the baby was born. I know. No, he also had a rash, and later someone told me that he was spending a lot of time. Someone who was going to be researching psoriasis on his computer, but nothing that anybody said to me. Until the baby was born, before he was diagnosed with his illness, two things, and I don't know if you want to, those two things were...
Not yet.
Yeah. He was sitting on we visited my folks in Philadelphia, and he was sitting on the front stoop. He was a chain smoker, and my father, one of his great worshipers, because he thought he loved him, and he really admired him. My father said, "What's wrong with him?" That was the first thing. Now, the baby had just been born by that point.
Okay.
The other thing was, we got together with his family, and he had incessant hiccups, and we were laughing about it because it's really funny when someone has hiccups. You try to scare them, you put the glass of water, but the hiccups couldn't stop. I think we didn't talk about it, but we all thought, well, wow, this is weird. But those are the two instances I can think of.
So again, you were paying attention, you got the information that anyone would have given you during that time in those days, given who he was, and given who you were and given what your lives were like.
Right.
Maggie, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up with his birthday dinner. You talk about, and now everyone will know, a birthday dinner in which you became actually quite alarmed. So that's where I'd like to pick up.
Okay.
When we return, folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk. Stay right where you are. This is an amazing story that you won't want to miss. So stay where you are. Maggie, there was a time when you and your husband went out for his birthday dinner, the typical activity, but you became quite alarmed with what was going on with your husband. What was going on with your husband?
Well, okay, it was a hot summer night in July, on the night of his birthday in 1990, and I'd had our son about 3 weeks before. And I took that evening as an opportunity to take him out to celebrate his 36th birthday. It was his favorite restaurant in Greenwich Village. We went. He met me there from work. He worked in Lower Manhattan. I went in from Hoboken, and he looked really tired. It was about 90-something degrees, so even John, who really was always very dapper and well-kept, he looked a little afraid. And he sat down, and we ordered our food, and we were going, and he had his drink. He usually had a gin and tonic, and the ice-cold drink came, and we made, I think, a little small talk, but then he said something that really alarmed me, which was, you know, we need more ketchup, and he held up the ashtray in which his cigarette was resting, and I said, I thought he was kidding. I said, John, that's not, the ketchup's right over there. He just sort of stared at me, and I suddenly, the feeling of your stomach falling to the plummeting, you know, I thought, he doesn't know what he's saying. And I said, John. He didn't say anything. So I remember running to the phone. We didn't have cell phones in 1990.
Right.
iPhones. And it really feels like pioneer times almost when you talk about it. But I had to find change to make a cell phone, a payphone call.
Definitely the old days.
In the old days, right? You rustle around, you panic. You rustle in your wallet. You find your wallet. You find your change. You count it, and you go to the phone. And he had a brother with whom he was very close. In Connecticut, and I called his brother. I had to tell somebody, and I knew that we knew we were close to him, and he was his brother. And he kind of calmed me down a little bit, said, get him home. I went back hoping that he was, hey, whoa, gee, how are you? He's down with him, but he just sort of sat there smoking, not saying anything. I just thought, I've got to get him home. I didn't try to talk to him anymore. So I paid the bill. We had barely eaten, and I got him out to a cab. These cabs are being prevalent in New York City, fortunately. And then I felt his forehead at the time, and it was burning up.
Mm.
And so I managed to get him home through the Lincoln Tunnel, Hoboken being very close to Lower Manhattan, and through the Holland Tunnel, Lower Manhattan. And then got him. He was weak and hot, and I kept feeling him in the car. Those of any of us who've had children know you feel your kids, even people who don't, you feel anybody. You want to feel a fever break. But he was hotter than I'd ever felt anybody. I got him upstairs and got him to bed, and that was the experience of the restaurant on that night that kind of really changed everything. The night that changed everything in my life, certainly, and certainly his.
And again, I mean, just the panic and the fear. And you are, at this point, the mother of two young children.
Yes.
You just had a second child. And your husband was so young. I mean, so there's nothing to think except, wow, you know, maybe this is a cold or the flu, or there's nothing else for you to really think. But this turned into an absolute emotional roller coaster, didn't it? Talk about the roller coaster.
Well, the roller coaster, the immediate roller coaster was just what you described, Pamela. You know, you immediately, when you take someone young, homesick like that, you start to think, you know, whoa, what is this? Is there some bug going around? I thought back, all kinds of sometimes semi-irrational or totally irrational things occur to you. Could this be a quote-unquote nervous breakdown? You remember growing up, again, the secretive aspect of people's nervous breakdowns in your own neighborhood, usually fathers disappearing for a while. What happened to Bud or Sam? You know, you'd hear your parents talk. Then I thought about, I thought a million things. Can you have fever when you have a nervous breakdown? I knew that John had begun to see a psychiatrist, and I put in a call to that person, and he said, well, he said he was calm. I got a lot of calm response from people, which was, I think, was helpful because every calm response told me this would be okay. And John had an appointment with him that next morning to see how he was in the morning. And I thought, well, he must be I deduced from that this was a typical thing. There were a lot of fevers around. And I kind of got through the night that way.
Sure.
And then the next morning, John miraculously seemed fine. He was conscious. His forehead was cool. He was dressed for work. And I thought, well, that's that. Let's see what this was. This must have been a 24-hour bug. We will be laughing about this someday, how panicked I was. I also thought that I was in the throes of postpartum depression, and I pulled out Dr. Spock, our Bible back then, for that. I'm not sure that it is anymore for women with small children. But
it was then.
It was then. Like, yes. Dr. Benjamin Spock, I mean, whatever he said went, you know. And I read about postpartum depression, and it talked about how you could have delusions. I thought, oh, this is me, not him. So he went off to work that morning. Good as new, I thought.
Now, let's sort of skip ahead a little bit. You had an interesting, if not scary, conversation with Dr. Rothstein. Tell us a little bit about those circumstances.
Well, I guess I should say now that that conversation was this was the beginning of the next 25 years of my life, a controlling factor. I was on the phone. What happened after that quickly as the book reports, John went to work. He had lunch with his brother. During that time, somebody contacted John to go to the hospital. The psychiatrist had noticed that morning that John had not been clear, had not written his check correctly. I even thought back then, I always write the wrong check. I always write the wrong number on the check, the wrong date on the check. What is he talking about? But it was John not writing the check correctly that tipped the psychiatrist off something. This could be more. He managed to get to John to get him to go to the hospital where they did a brain scan. And he had lesions on his brain. So I got a call. I had gone out to lunch that day with a friend's brother who was in town and really felt great, relaxed. We're good. We're all good. John's well. My children are beautiful. And I had a little babysitter from downstairs, came home, and she said there are a lot of messages on the machine, and there were about 12 flashing lights. And I called. There's a doctor, hospital. And I called back this doctor who had called me like 3 or 4 times, and he said, he called me, he said, your husband has lesions on his brain. And I, oh my God, I said, he said, we think it's lymphoma, which is a form of cancer. And I was like, that sounds terrible. And then I heard myself say in that phone call, could this be AIDS? And I literally did not predetermine that. AIDS had not occurred to me the night before. It had not occurred to me 5 seconds before. When I heard myself say that, I realized that somewhere dormant, and this would be more in your lexicon or your neck of the woods,
yes,
as someone who works with people and these issues, whatever that was in me, I had clearly buried that somewhere. I had been in the theater, and I had lost a lot of friends by then to AIDS. I had seen them precipitously decline through many infections that were visible and in fact die. And all of a sudden it just came to me, he's been that sick over the past few months. He is that sick. And when I said that when I proposed it to the doctor, there was of course palpable silence. And the doctor said, why do you ask that? And I said, because everything is wrong with him.
Yeah.
And that was the moment, I think, you're about what you're asking.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is wrong.
Right.
Talk about the phone call that you got where they asked you to come in and take a test.
So, the phone call was, some time passed. I managed to call my own parents. I had to talk to somebody. I didn't know who to talk to. Of course, I want to talk to my own parents. And then they called me the next day and said, we think this is it. We don't have his results back. But clearly by then they knew what they were looking at in 1990 in someone that sick. They knew what it was. And they said, you need to come in for an AIDS test. And I heard myself again, the power of denial, whatever you call it. I was like, oh, I can't. You know, my daughter has a swimming lesson. I have to, we have a play date schedule. I found and they said, you have to come in. You've got to get here. And I had to go. And I did get there. I had some lovely young girls, high school girls downstairs who were available whenever I needed them, fortunately, so I could run out and take the bus. But in those days, and even now, you take a bus to the PATH train. I had to take a bunch of public transportation.
Right.
Got to this doctor on the Upper East Side where John was in the hospital and walked into this waiting room of a doctor in which everybody was a young man visibly ill. because he was an infectious disease doctor.
What was that like for you, that moment when you realized where you were? Or did you realize?
I thought, when am I going to wake up from this nightmare?
Okay.
That's what I thought. I thought, how have I ended up in a waiting room that's filled with young, mostly, I assumed, gay men with AIDS? How did I get here? I'm a young mother of two from a safe little hamlet in New Jersey. I am married to a prestigious straight man. How is it that I've ended up here? That's what I thought. I don't belong here, I thought. And of course, I was trying not to think how scared to death I was that perhaps I too would be ill. And what about my children?
It's almost chilling to, you know, as you kind of imagine what that moment was like for you when everything that you didn't want to know sort of came rushing into your head and you didn't want to know it, so you wanted to change it. I mean, it really is kind of chilling just to be in that moment with you as you describe it. Indeed, your test came back and you were fine and your children were fine, which was a good thing.
Right.
But there came a time when your husband was released into your care. But let me ask you this. You've got this information that your husband has this illness that, as far as you know, as far as anybody thought in those days, the only people who got that were gay men.
That's right.
And your husband clearly wasn't gay.
So I thought. That's right.
Exactly. So talk about the moment that John disclosed to you some other truths in his life that stunned you.
Okay. So before that, Pamela, you know, I get him home and he says, now everyone will know that I have AIDS. And I'm like, why do you say that? He says, because you're going to tell them. So he placed that on me originally because I was a very effusive personality, which he liked because he used to call me his original spark of life. I was very lively. He was quieter. But the point that you're talking about, the moment you're talking about, is when he was in the hospital. And I was before my own before my own diagnosis. So I wasn't sure yet whether I was well. And I went in to see him because I had to. It was time to see him. I didn't want to see him. I didn't want to see this man who had put me in this position, a man I thought I had once known so well and clearly did not. And I went in and I asked him, I said to him, I remember saying to him, he was lying there, how did you get AIDS? And he said, he asked me if I slept with one of our friends who had died of AIDS. And I, of course, had not, fortunately, for many reasons, but I had not slept with anyone else since being married. And I said no, and I asked him again, how he got it. And he told me then that he slept with men in L.A. He had lived in Los Angeles and worked there. And I remember at that moment just turning on my heel and walking out of that room and meeting up with my father, who was holding my then 3-week-old son, and leaving, and then just kind of turning off. Because I had so many responsibilities, Pamela. You know, I had very, very small children. So first of all, I had to take care of them on a round-the-clock basis. I also had to make sure to manage information right away because no one could know, in fact, what John had in 1990.
Right.
And I'm not sure even now, to tell you the truth, but that's a whole other conversation.
Indeed it is.
Right.
But the enormity of a life-changing, you know, in the scheme of things, tiny little sentence, I slept with men in L.A., you know, it's not a lot of words, but certainly the life-changing impact of that for you and for him, because now his secret was out, clearly. I mean, it's just hard to imagine what that was like for you as you left with your father and your son and traveled home. All the turmoil that was going on inside makes sense that you would sort of turn off because it was almost too much to think about.
Right. I think that, and I write about this, and this is one thing that I learned through the writing process. I was incredibly, palpably angry about what had happened in my life and marriage. And that anger was tamped down for a really long time. It was really hard. I couldn't, and I think there was a lot of catharsis, if I may, there was a lot, this is what I think, I think there was a lot of catharsis for gay men dealing with this disease. many of them could step out for the first time, come out, be proud, say, this is who we are. It was a highly tragic and dramatic moment, for, and a changing moment, change agent moment for the gay community. But for me, it was a time of pulling in and trying to manage anger and not letting on that this had happened. So I think that it was a very damaging situation for me, and I also had to appear very cheerful. I was a young mother. I had to smile. I had to lie, and this went on for a long time.
Did you tell your parents at that point?
I told my parents right away.
Okay.
My parents really reverted immediately to being completely supportive, and also supportive towards John, which I thought said a lot about them as people.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they loved who he was, period. I mean, they loved him.
The thing about my parents were they had gone through life the hard way. People in that generation, they had gone through life through war, through poverty, through the Depression, the Holocaust, all of those things. And they were just kind of bootstrap people. And, you know, my father had a famous expression, never complain, never explain. I grew up in Detroit till I was 13, and that was Henry Ford II. And he kept quoting that. Don't ever whine about it. Don't talk about it. We just have to, let's keep going. That was my parents.
Let's just push through it.
Yes, just barrel through.
The day that your husband was released from the hospital and he was coming home with you, and now you know he's got this illness.
Right.
You are clear as to what all these multiple medical conditions are that he's been dealing with. And now he's coming home to you in your care. And you're, quite frankly, really angry with him, with your life, with all that you know and don't know is going to confront you in the days and years to come. What was it like bringing him home to care for him?
What was it like? It was surreal. It was surreal. I just remember managing. I mean, holding one child, holding the hand of another, and helping him up the two flights of our condo. You know, changing three sets of diapers. Helping him, feeding three people. This went on for some weeks. I couldn't have people up because they couldn't see him. So that was the reality of it. I also, at the same time, had a moment of real clarity and relief when the managing editor of his newspaper called me in, and I went in to see him about a week after John had not been at work, and there was kind of a low hum of questioning. And these were all very serious journalists. They probably were getting some aspect of the story in play. But the managing editor said to ask me what John had, and I said I can't tell you. And like, he didn't know.
Yeah.
I was sure he knew. And he provided car services for us to get to the doctors in the city, and he provided insurance. The insurance company back then was we don't know if we can reimburse for this disease back then in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a lot of help that a lot of other women and other people in the situation definitely didn't get and still don't. So on that end of things, where you worry about all this, I was breathing. But in terms of managing things at home and managing the information flow of what was at home, I was struggling.
Well, and you talk about the car service was, so important, because you talk about the appointments that John had either with a dermatologist or a vascular surgeon or a neurologist or a cardiologist or a gastro. I mean, there were endless doctor's appointments. So a young mom living outside of the city with doctor's appointments in the city, two babies, I don't know how you would have made it without the assistance of that car service, which, you know, a lot of people, as you say, just don't have access to.
I don't honestly know, Pamela, how I would have made it without the help of John's newspaper, the help of John's family, his brother and sister-in-law, who were right there trying to help me, my own parents, and a couple of key, very discreet friends. I don't think I would have made it. I really don't. I don't know how people do make it.
It's pretty extraordinary what people put up with. And what they have to put up with and navigate just to get through one single day. Maggie, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to really jump forward to a time when you discovered that the school that your children were attending had some issues.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer continuing conversation with Maggie Knipe, the author of her memoir, which is entitled Now Everyone Will Know, The Perfect Husband, His Shattering Secret, My Rediscovered Life. We'll be right back. Maggie, talk about the day and the way in which you learned that the school your children were attending, they didn't want your children to attend anymore.
Okay, I think that in retrospect, I understand, I have to say, I've come to understand how people might have been afraid of us back then.
Sure.
But it was a pretty hip little hamlet outside New York City, so I think when this happened, I was naively surprised. It was just that I had my older child was, she was aware of what was going on. My younger child was 9 months, just barely 9 months when his father died. So he didn't know his father. He had lacked awareness of what was happening, mercifully for him. But my older child was approaching three, and, she was disturbed by what was going on. Her father had disappeared. Her father at some point midstream in his 8 and a half, nearly 9 months of illness, he went to an apartment his brother had in the city, because I could no longer manage things. So all of a sudden, her dad had disappeared. He wasn't the same as he'd been. So she was acting out a little bit in preschool, and the teachers didn't know how to handle it. I think the teachers might have been afraid, too. Anyway, I heard one day, about a year after John died, elder child was very bright, and they had put her back a year because they didn't think she was emotionally ready to move on, and I was upset about it. And someone told me on the street that there had been a vote taken this is a private school, at a meeting asking if people were comfortable with their children going to school with mine. And so at that moment, I realized that there was certain, obviously, level of ignorance, whether it was forgivable or not, that at the time I didn't think it was, about who we were and John's situation. I was kind of between a rock and a hard place. I
Absolutely.
Couldn't say what he had because people would really then run, you know, screaming from the room. I couldn't lie about it, so I didn't talk about it, but I couldn't manage the information successfully enough. I was lucky enough at that time to have gotten a job with an educational publishing company, and they knew a teacher, a principal at a progressive Manhattan public school, and we went there, and my daughter was put up to appropriate grade, even more one up from there because she was so bright, I felt, and that was appropriate. In the meantime, this is a second school experience. They read the book by, I don't know how to pronounce, Jean Montesami Ash, I believe, Montesami Ash,
okay.
Who wrote about Arthur Ashe's life for their young daughter, Camera. And it was a beautiful book. And one of the very aware, excellent teachers at school, apparently my daughter, when being read the book, said, my daddy died of that. And she called me, and I thought, oh, no, here's another school problem. And she, in fact, said, we should work with her to my daughter to teach her how to say it and what not to say. And that's when I learned, that was the moment at which I had my next course in managing information. And when each child turned 5, and that's what my daughter was at the time, I learned how to talk to them about what had happened to their father, what to say and what not to say.
You know, I'm just thinking about you walking on, being on the street, and someone tells you that there's been a vote taken and folks don't want your children in the school. I mean, the enormity of hearing that information, the enormity of getting the diagnosis about your husband, the enormity of being asked to come in to an infectious disease doctor so that you too can receive a test to see if you have it. What would you say were some of the strengths and the skills that you pulled on for yourself to actually get through all of these things?
I think that first of all, the overwhelming feeling from all these experiences was shame and anger. How I got through was to, I knew that I had a mission, which was to raise my children, the children that with whom I had been left to raise. I think the prevailing feeling, Pamela, over the years since that time was, it was my mission to make their lives as stigma-free and beautiful as I could. And so that drove me. That was my prevailing source of strength, much of it.
Who did you have? I mean, I hear your focus on your children, which is certainly understandable. But who was there for you? It sounds like you had your parents. Did you have very close friends you could talk to? Or
yes.
Okay.
I write about this quite a bit. You have to learn who to trust, and it's very hard to know who to trust. And people sort of sometimes, there's kind of a revolving door that can come into play. People sometimes you can trust don't end up being that. You can trust them for a few years, and they sort of disappear. They can't handle the stress of handling your issues. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I had, anywhere I lived, practically I had a good amount of support from relatives, a good amount. And again, I was lucky. I had support from friends, some friends of John's, some coworkers of John, reporters and editors have stayed my friends to this day, and they were very much supportive of my life and my story and my need to tell it. And I had some friends who were unconditionally supportive. I also had a psychiatrist for all those years, religiously, regularly, to whom I spoke. And I had some clergy off and on who understood the issues of folks, had many different stories in their parishes and their synagogue congregations. I had friends who were ministers, and I had belonged to synagogues. So there was a kind of a collection of people who helped me. I also had, my children were 5 and 3, I took on a partner who is with me to this day. I, like many people, I felt that I couldn't marry again. Many people who, I say this because having written the book, I've become involved with people who are, there are people, many people today who are talking more about being in mixed orientation marriages.
Yes.
And it's an issue that's surfaced. I don't know if you've encountered it. I would assume you have.
Yes.
I certainly have. And marriages are either deciding how to work with that, or they're breaking up pretty radically from that. And I managed to find a man who I knew could be loyal to me and loyal to my children, and he has been. So he's been kind of a rock for me. This is where I derive support.
So it sounds like you really did reach out, which is important, and you were met with a number of different people in a number of different arenas who were able to be helpful.
Yes.
For those who are listening who actually may be in similar situations as we speak, may just have discovered that a loved one has this illness and didn't know what was going on, what would you say to them?
I think I would say, it depends on the nature of the illness, but I guess any illness, when they didn't know what was going on, I would say first, find someone in your family, and here's hoping you have someone you can trust, because I think in its best sense, the family is the place to start. I say that knowing a lot of people don't have that.
Yes.
In which case, I am keenly aware of that. In which case, you would look for, if you're lucky, a close friend. Or you want to call a professional, kind of professional. This is my point of view as a layperson. Get the referral of a good psychologist or psychiatrist first. And if you know the nature of the illness, let's assume you do, find a group. Today, with the internet, we did not have it. I mean, it was very limited in 1990. You have many opportunities online to find people who are going through what you're going through.
It's very true.
That's where I would start. I also recommend, there are certain things I recommend in terms of meditation, meditative self-treatment, but that comes after you find these sources of support.
What is your life like today, and your children are adults today? How are they faring?
My children have moved on with their lives. What I learned, a key lesson I learned from this book, when I first wrote the book and I was first starting to publish it, I wanted them to come in on it with me. I thought we'd all remember their father, but they didn't really know their father. So they've moved on with their lives. They're very supportive of the fact that I needed to tell my story, but I don't think they feel at all that it's their story.
Okay. And what about you? What's your life like today?
My life today is, in some ways, it's infinitely easier in that I approach people with a certain kind of openness that I didn't before and talk about my past freely. And in some ways, it is getting easier. And that is, in telling this story, I have had some people don't know what to make of me. They didn't know this happened. I would say some family is cautiously supportive. This is not a story that, AIDS is not something I think you talk about with any degree of ease. It is one of those diseases. There are several others. Charlie Sheen coming out recently, I think a lot of us have heard about that or saw him on the Today Show. I think Charlie Sheen and that whole story breaking the way it does 25 years after mine took place indicates how uncomfortable society is still with this topic.
Still.
It is still very much in the world and in our country. And I think I'm hoping that people can find support that I wasn't able to. Now, I know that it is available online. I know that it is available for people in marriages, very prevalently.
It is available, and you're right. I mean, there's been literally an explosion, I think, of awareness and support. And, of course, nowadays with medications, it's not the same kind of death sentence that when your husband first contracted the illness.
Right.
The idea, one of the things that you say in your book, which I thought was important to be able to talk about, was your anger with him. And the reason that I thought that was important is because so many times people, for whatever reason, do not feel as though it's okay to be angry.
Right.
But not only is it okay, but it's actually healthy and human. What you do with it is, you know, can often be another story. But can you talk for a bit about your anger towards your husband then and what your thoughts and feelings are towards him today as we speak?
I think that seeing the way the world has changed, which this also prompted me to write the book, seeing the openness in society towards lifestyle fluidity and sexual and gender preference or lifestyle has helped me understand how closeted my husband needed to be back in 1990 and in the 80s. So I understand much more of the nuanced situation of his life, the conflicts of his life. So in that to that degree, I've been able to forgive him, because you could not come out the way you can today back then. You
right.
could not try to have the normal life you wanted back then, which you can today. Normal, if you will, being maybe taking out a family and being open about who you were. So to that end, my anger has dissipated towards him, and I have put it, that is really my rediscovered life. And how I did that was I kind of plunged myself right into the world of AIDS, the post-AIDS world. I watched films. I went to plays. I saw Angels in America, spent 6 hours huddled over my computer watching Angels in America, which I believe is a brilliant depiction of the AIDS crisis in this country. And through various activity, active pursuit of understanding my feelings, my anger, I was able to release it. If there's any residual anger, it's that I still sometimes can't talk about this. People don't like to hear it. They don't want to know it. And I really feel that it's important to talk about, and I think people who have responded to my book have indicated that it is.
Well, you know, I would certainly agree clearly that it's important to talk about, and the way in which you talk about it is very human, it's very honest, and I suspect there will be people who, after reading this, will find the space and the energy to share their own stories, because certainly we know, even today, that your story is not unique in that there are people who are still living double lives, secret lives, and don't feel the freedom or the safety to disclose what's going on. Maggie Knipe, again, it's a wonderful piece of a look into your life and into your husband's life. Now everyone will know the perfect husband, his shattering secret, my rediscovered life. Is there a website or a way that people can learn more about you or the book?
Yes, Pamela, it's very easy. Although my last name isn't so easy, so I'll spell it. It's my website is www.maggie.kneip.com. From there, there's much more information about the book.
Okay. So again, that's maggieknneip.com.
I will say P as in Paul. A lot of people think it's T. I've been through many years of spelling my name. Yeah, it's a P at the end. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. All right. Again, Maggie, I do appreciate your time today. I certainly appreciate the energy and the honesty with which you have approached your story. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Pamela. It was my pleasure and honor to talk to you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to listen to this program or any Mind Talk program again, you can always do so by going to myndtalk.org. You can certainly email your questions or comments or suggestions for further programming to myndtalk@aol.com. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And of course, you know, folks, if it's unacceptable, if it's really unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.